From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The third Senate impeachment trial in America kicked off today with a prayer.
Lord, as our senators prepare to gather for today's impeachment trial, we declare that you alone are our hope.
That's Senate Chaplain Barry Black. Next, we heard from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who's proposed a resolution that each side have 24 hours, 12 a day over 4 days, to present arguments, followed by a debate over witnesses.
On every point, our straightforward resolution will bring the clarity and fairness that everyone deserves. The President of the United States, the House of Representatives, and the American people.
Of course, Democrats see things differently. Here's Senate Minority Leader, the Democrat Chuck Schumer.
The McConnell rules seem to be designed by President Trump for President Trump. It asks the Senate to rush through as fast as possible and makes getting evidence as hard as possible.
Well, NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell has been following all of this in Washington. And Kelsey, it sounds as if Mitch McConnell is going to stick to his plan to run the trial as he planned. Do Democrats have any hope of getting any of the changes they want? What are some of them?
Well, some of the changes they want, they want to introduce witnesses and evidence, and they want to vote on that before they even get started with this testimony or the arguments that are supposed to take up those 24 hours, 12 days, 12 hours a day, as you mentioned. You know, I think it's really helpful to think about today as being all about procedure and the trial itself really getting started in earnest tomorrow. And this procedural stuff, while it can be confusing, is really important because when it comes to something like an impeachment trial where the precedent is so slim, they're essentially battling to be the baseline for any future impeachments, not just for the way things are going to run right now. And, you know, McConnell is basically saying that he is going to ask the Senate to vote down any attempts to change the rules that he's put out there. And Democrats are saying they're going to do everything they can to try to get the rules changed. But at the end of the day, they need 51 votes to make any amendments, any changes at all in this entire trial. Democrats have 47 members. And that means that they need at least four Republicans to join them if they want to get anything done.
Well, we should say Chief Justice Roberts isn't even there today. I mean, he's not overseeing this. And when we talk about the witnesses, the Washington Post is reporting that the White House is prepping a plan B just in case Democrats do get those votes you mentioned to subpoena John Bolton. Republicans could force that testimony to be classified, or the president could signal executive privilege. I think we might have heard a little of that from Mitch McConnell already. So what's the sense of whether they anticipate there might have to be a plan B?
Well, the idea that it's all subject to this 51-vote threshold is kind of what makes it a little bit of a Wild West version of the Senate. Usually, that's not how things work. So it's going to be very interesting to watch what coalitions of people get along behind things and whether or not Democrats can find a fourth Republican to join them on anything at all. Because we've heard from Mitt Romney, as you mentioned, but also Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, saying that they are open to the concept of witnesses or potentially John Bolton in specific, but they still need a fourth Republican if they're going to get anywhere on this. And that's something that Democrats are still working on.
Talk a little bit about President Trump's defense team. We've heard from some members over the past few days, Alan Dershowitz, for instance, saying, yes, the president did the things he's accused of, but it's not a crime. That seemed to be the constitutional case he's going to make. Of course, the founders said impeachment was a process for those who violated the public trust. But do we get the sense that anyone on the legal team is going to say that the president didn't do the things that we already know his chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, told reporters? Yeah, he did.
Well, the brief that they put out over the weekend, it does not indicate that that's an argument that they're attempting to make. Though one of the interesting things about the McConnell resolution, the thing that sets up the rules, is that they basically are saying that the White House and House Democrats have to establish the new set of facts, that because the House record is not being automatically admitted as the foundation of the arguments here, we could see the White House try to set up a new set of facts. But we haven't seen them preview that yet. That's not what their brief indicated. That doesn't mean it couldn't happen.
Yeah. By the way, the White House announced yesterday that 8 Republican congresspeople will be part of the president's team, not the legal team, but what team? These are some of the more hyperpartisan people from the House inquiry, Doug Collins, Jim Jordan. What exactly will they do?
Well, they are basically political supporters, right? You're right. These are some of the president's closest defenders. They don't have a legal role here. They may just be there for moral support and for kind of showing the president that he has Republicans in Congress at his back.
NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell, just briefly, what's it like there in Washington?
It is tense. This is not a version of the Senate that I have ever seen in the 10 years I've been covering Congress. It is just a completely different, more hostile environment.
Oh, Kelsey, thank you.
Well, as history unfolds in the Senate, journalists covering the trial face new restrictions on where they can go and where they can speak to senators. For more on that, we're joined by NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, here is Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor today talking about these very concerns that reporters might miss parts of the trial because of additional security measures.
The press is here to inform the American public about these pivotal events in our nation's history. We must make sure they are able to. Some may not want what happens here to be public. We do.
David, lay out these new security measures and the rules for the media during the trial. How much access are reporters going to have?
Well, I mean, they'll be able to witness it from the Senate press gallery. They'll be able to be in the Capitol building and in the surroundings. But, you know, it's going to be much more restrictive than, for example, was done during the Clinton impeachment 2 decades ago. You're basically going to have a magnetometer so that reporters can't dash in from I used to work there, but the Senate press gallery, just sort of dash through the swinging doors and come into the gallery and see what's going on. They're going to have to go. There's a magnetometer, so they won't be able to take smartphones in there. They're not going to be able to basically capture things or text editors and say this development has just happened, or tweet or email sources and say, what the heck does this motion mean? They're going to have to come back out to do it. There may well be a line in front of the magnetometer to do it. It's going to be much harder to have sort of instantaneous coverage in that way. Reporters are going to be, as I understand it, penned on a single small pen on the second floor of the Senate during the trial. Usually you're able to kind of approach senators in the corridors, the hallways, when they're trying to take these little it's almost like Disneyland-like tiny shuttle back to the buildings mm-hmm. underground where they work. That's an easy way to get senators to talk, sometimes on tape, sometimes on background, steering you, letting you know what's going on. And there's the question of the control of the camera recording events itself. Now, this is consistent with what happened 20 years ago, which is that it's controlled by the Senate. The audio, the angles, when they stop, when they start, how the feed is shown, and that feed is then conveyed to the public by commercial outlets or public broadcasters. But they don't get to control the camera. That is done by the Senate. That's consistent, but it is, again, something that C-SPAN and others have raised objections about, saying, well, then you're only really getting to see what the Senate wants you mm-hmm. to see.
And in terms of the rules you were just talking about, where people can't just – reporters can't just run up to the senators and ask them what they want to know, who set those rules and why?
Technically, this is done by the Sergeant-at-Arms of the Senate and the Senate Rules Committee. But really, this is carrying out the wishes of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He's wanted a tight leash on this. He's not eager for this to, you know, be conveyed to the public. He doesn't particularly want his senators asked about it, and a lot of footage or audio of his senators being asked day after day, well, what about this evidence? What about that evidence? Are you going to support the president no matter what? These are tough questions, particularly for senators facing reelection, especially for Republicans, but not only Republicans. They are really kind of trying to present this, you know, think of it this way. In some ways, it suggests that journalism is going to perform a stenographic function. We're going to report precisely what we get to see on the camera. We're going to report what people decide voluntarily to come out and announce at the end of the day or at the end of a session. And it's going to be harder for senators to have questions posed to them that are either inconvenient or in confidence, where people might say, look, this is what's happening behind the scenes. These are not fully digested proceedings. These things are fluid, and people's sentiments can change over time. People may feel different pressures as things play out in public view. And it's harder to get at that if you're being penned in a small square, mm-hmm. you know, on the second floor of the Senate.
Well, and if the trial is going to go for 12 hours a day, these senators aren't going to be able to go out and be on TV at night and tell people what they think either. What kind of a difference do you think that these media restrictions are going to make for people around the country who are following the trial?
You know, I think that part of the question is going to be, are people going to have time to digest what it is that's been done in public view and what's happening out of public view, and that it may be more difficult for reporters to do the contextual reporting, do the source work necessary to get at what's below the surface and then maybe what's below that secondary level. This is going to require a lot of contextualization, a lot of legal analysis, a lot of political insight of what's happening on the Senate floor, and it's going to provide require a lot of reporting as well. And I think that it will affect and in some ways make harder the journalistic task of keeping viewers, listeners, readers fully informed and given fully contextualized information. I think it makes it much more challenging. You know, I covered the Clinton impeachment mm-hmm. 20 years ago. We had the run of the place to say to senators, what does this mean? Why did you raise this point in a written question? Mm-hmm. What did your colleague mean by this? Where do you think this is headed? That insight helps. And they're human interactions that are not always as contentious as what we sometimes see.
That is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
NPR's Code Switch is a podcast about race in America that's about all of us. Our histories, how we're represented, the ways we've worked together and worked against each other. You'll learn. You might get mad. You'll definitely laugh. But don't take my word for it. Just listen to NPR's Code Switch.
Toy Story 4, the latest movie in the popular Pixar series, has been nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Feature Film. It introduces a new character, Forky, who is handmade by a kid out of a spork, pipe cleaner, and some mismatched googly eyes.
Bonnie made a friend in class.
What a kid. Oh,
she's already making friends.
No, she literally made a new friend.
Hey, it's okay. Come on out. That's it. Come on, there you go.
Come on, let's get you out of there. You got this. Good, good. Everyone, I want you to meet Forky.
Golly, Bob Hat.
Look how long his arms are.
Forky is voiced by the actor Tony Hale, who played Buster Bluth in Arrested Development and was Selena's devoted bagman Gary on Veep. He won an Emmy for that role in 2013. I talked to Tony Hale last June when Toy Story 4 was released. Forky, the character that he plays, can be described as being neurotic, anxious, and uncertain. Seems like a very Tony Hale character.
Yep. They pitched. That's how they pitched him to me. They're like, you know, we have this spork who's has a little bit of a neurotic energy, and we thought of you. And I was like, check.
Sounds about right. So you're still interested in playing characters like that?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've had a history of kind of struggling with anxiety in my past, so it's nice to be used for good.
And do you think now, given how well known your roles are from Veep and from Arrested Development, that people now, a new generation, is going to see you always as Forky?
Which I would love. I mean, I love what Forky represents. He kind of started into this world with one purpose, and that's to help people eat chili and then go to the trash. And I love that Woody comes along and is like, no, you were made for a purpose and you have great value. And I think, you know, on a meta level, what a beautiful message if somebody, you know, might think that's their only route or how they see themselves or maybe how they've been treated. And, you know, everybody has such great value and purpose.
I read that before you became an actor, you got a journalism degree.
I did. I studied journalism and mass communications at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama.
Did you want to be a journalist?
Ish. I enjoyed the advertising part about it. I interned at an advertising agency. I loved kind of coming up with ads and slogans and stuff. However, the really interesting, cool part about it is right now I'm executive producing a cartoon that was based on a book I did years ago about kind of learning how to be present and stuff. And right now, a lot of my journalistic skills that I learned at college have kind of cutting off the unnecessary fat mm-hmm. of like an article
editing.
Or editing and all that kind of stuff. It's like I'll read through the scripts and be like, yeah, we've already said that. We don't need that. This needs to speed up. We need to get quicker. All that stuff was learned in college.
And when you're acting in either a TV show or a movie like this one, do you have the ability to change the lines, to do that kind of editing as you go?
Somewhat, yeah. I mean, it's in Toy Story. The interesting thing about being in Toy Story was no one really was able to read a full script. they wanted to kind of keep it under wraps and stuff, and which really helped Forky because Forky is so confused about mm-hmm. everything. He had no idea why he was there or what's happening next. And so it really was easy to get into that because I had no clue what was happening.
You hadn't read the whole script. You weren't able to do
that. No, I had no idea what was going on. And Forky's very much a blank slate. Like, he's always asking questions, no clue what's happening. So it really helped because I genuinely had no clue what was going on. And whereas, like, on Veep or Arrested Development, there was a real freedom of like, yeah, I feel like we've already done this, especially with comedy, because you're always thinking this can be done quicker, you know, sharper. Let's let it turn the comedy and all that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of input that they were very open to.
And as you're voicing this, you're not doing it all together, or are you? I mean, do you hear the responses? You just do it individually.
Yeah, you do it really individually. And it's interesting because fortunately been able to do other animation, but coming from doing on-camera or live-action comedy, mm-hmm. you're so reliant on your physicality, mm-hmm. especially playing Gary on Veep, because Selina Meyer never even let me speak. So I was described as like a bitchy mime because the only way I could communicate was non-verbally. And so to then go from that into animation where it's just the microphone, it's just your voice. And, you know, at times it's a little intimidating when you're just kind of in a booth and there's just this kind of piece of glass in between you and you, all the directors and stuff are on the other side of it. But Pixar really set up a different situation where we were all in the same room, not the actors, but with the writers and the producers mm-hmm. and directors. They really created this kind of collaborative, family-like environment, which was a very different energy.
You mentioned Gary from Veep there, and let's hear a little bit of this. This series obviously just ended in May, but here's a clip of Gary and Selena, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, having an argument.
You are unimportant, okay? And you have suckered on to me like some sort of a car window Garfield.
That is not true, ma'am.
You think you're some sort of a big shot here? Oh, my God, you are not a big shot, Gary. You're a middle-aged man who sanitizes my tweezers. God.
You're wrong.
Excuse me?
When's Catherine's birthday?
June 8th.
9th. Which senator's daughter's in rehab?
You're out of line, Missy.
Gildray, what are you wearing tomorrow?
I don't know.
I do. I'm your calendar. I'm your Google. I'm your Wilson the volleyball.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
Are you sad that that show is over?
Yes, I'm so sad. I think because our characters were so abused and so atrocious to each other that we balanced it with just being crazy in love with each other offset. Like, we just had the best time together. We loved each other. And I honestly, I of course, miss the material in Gary. I mean, playing him was so fun. But I mainly miss the camaraderie because we were really close.
Which did you like doing better, Veep or Arrested Development?
Those were really different seasons in my life. I mean, the thing is, Arrested, you know, kind of kept coming back, but they were really, really different. I think just because Veep just ended, I'm my heart's there, and mm-hmm. I really miss that gang.
Okay, well, let me remind you of Arrested Development here with a clip that we have of that.
Okay.
Here it is.
Buster was taking his physical at the recruitment center.
A hole in my heart. I've never opened my eyes underwater. My, is shaped like... But without its shell, I guess I have the panic attacks under control. Oh, and I'm legally blind at night.
But Buster had miscalculated the Army's current need for personnel.
Okay, then. Let's get you fitted for a uniform.
What?
I forgot about that scene. It makes me laugh. The ironic thing is, side note, Julia, you know, was on Arrested Development. Mm-hmm. She played the blind lawyer. And we were asked on separate occasions if we ever had a scene together. And both of us on separate occasions were like, no. And then someone sent us a screenshot of us in a scene together on Arrested Development. So it's like clearly we both blocked it out.
Really? Why do you think that is?
I have no idea. We made no impact on each other's lives back in Arrested Development.
I've actually will often use, I don't know why or what the context is, but a line of yours as Buster when you said Army had half a day.
Yeah, no. And he also said, these are my awards from Army, Mother.
Right. These are my awards. These are for
my
sand
awards
racing.
From Army, Mother. Right. Yeah, he's very good at sand racing.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a favorite joke from either of those shows that sticks in your mind
oh
and you thought,
gosh.
Wow, this was the funniest thing I've ever had to say?
From Arrested Development, I got such joy out of Tobias being a part of the – thinking the Blue Man Group was a support group for depressed men. That made me laugh so hard. And just the signs, like you'll just see this random blue handprint on the wall. And it was just how that show just constantly – it was so dense and so many callbacks. And I'll never forget when – before my hand was eaten off by a seal – I remember seeing like hand signs and being like, that's interesting, because I didn't know my hand was coming off. And I remember Buster had a hand chair and I was like, what the hell's up with a hand chair? I don't know what's going on. Cut to no more hand.
You didn't know that your hand was coming off?
No, I had no clue my hand was coming off. And there was all these like foreshadowing of hand stuff.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, what's up with all the hand stuff? And Mitch is like, oh. And then, you know, of course, he knew that a seal was going to eat off my hand.
Loose seal.
Yeah. Right. Loose seal. And it was a loose seal. That's right.
What's next for you after Toy Story 4?
I did this children's book years ago called Archibald's Next Big Thing, and it was about a little chicken who's always looking to his next thing and missing where he is, and it was kind of learning how to be present. And now we're doing a children's series that's going to be coming out in the fall on Netflix, and now he's a chicken that just absolutely lives fully in the moment and sees the best in people and the best of situations. He goes on all these adventures, and there's a little sidekick named Bee, who in the book was like, you got to just be, man. You got to just be. And so now he just really is – he's pretty much my hero, this chicken.
Do you enjoy having an audience of people who are younger, kids in many cases, rather than adults?
I love it. I also especially love – creating something for children with this children's series, because it's so – the messages are so simple and just beautiful and just sweet. And, you know, the fact is even – I don't care how old you are, it's always those simplest messages that is what to me is the most profound.
What did you watch when you were a kid?
What did I watch? The Muppet Show. Mm-hmm. And my favorite Muppet was Scooter because he had glasses – and he was a nerd like me, and I was convinced he had asthma like me. So I would always put my inhaler in his hand and be like, that's my guy. It's funny. That's the one that probably stick, like Kermit singing the song on the rock, Miss Piggy, Gonzo. I loved Beaker.
Yeah.
Beaker made me laugh so hard. That, for some reason, The Muppet Show really, really stuck in my head the strongest.
You've got a friend in me.
My conversation from June of last year with Tony Hale, who is the voice of Forky in Toy Story 4, which is up for an Oscar for Best Animated Feature Film. The Oscars coming up on February 9th.
You just remember what your old past said, or you got a friend in me.
And as world leaders continue to meet on topics like global growth and climate change in Davos, Switzerland this week, their host organization, the World Economic Forum, has published some timely new numbers on social mobility, how hard or easy it is to move up in the world. In the U.S., it's not good. It takes, on average, 5 generations for a low-income family to reach medium income, about $60,000 a year. That puts the U.S. towards the bottom of the pack among developed nations. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, has been looking at this. And Robin, social mobility, you know, has been at the heart of the American dream. I just want to say at the outset, many African Americans have long known that that hasn't worked for them for generations. They know they've had generations of income gutted by racist, you know, lending and mortgage policies, right? But outside that, you know, many Americans believed in the American dream, and now we're learning it's easier to achieve it in Canada.
Yeah.
Right? It takes 4 generations in Canada. What's going on?
And the United States is nowhere on that headline chart that you saw issued from Davos. But if you start with widening income inequality, which is very particular to the U.S. especially, the top 1% of earners earned 160% roughly more than they did in 1979 versus just 24% for the bottom 90%. And this global social mobility index cites not just fair wages but also what social protections you have, working conditions, and you have lifelong learning and continuing education. And in the United States, you just don't have as robust a system or culture as you do in, say, Scandinavia or in Canada.
Well, it feels as if with the growing inequity, you know, income inequity and how much money families have, you also can make money off money. And so that generates wealth through generations. But this report shows in Denmark, for instance, a child born into poverty has just about the same likelihood of earning a high income in adulthood as a child born into a rich family. Why is that?
Well, you start with the bedrock assumptions, as in Denmark. Do you have working institutions, fair public schools? Are you collecting taxes and, by extension, maybe a progressive tax code that can redistribute income and maybe subsidize public health and education? That, again, is where Scandinavia stands out. You look at the top five, six players. You look at other countries, not just the United States, but South Africa, Brazil. There's corruption, income inequality. There isn't as robust a safety net.
Yeah. Well, and so in countries like Denmark, you have this ability to end run the notion that if, you know, somebody's parents are wealthy, they're going to go to the better schools. They're going to have the better family friends that get them the better jobs and the better companies. And it's just you can't compete with that. The authors of this report had some suggestions for breaking up that kind of, you know, that reality that people with wealthier parents tend to, you know,
sure,
do better.
What are there are recommendations for governments and private sectors across the developing and the developed world. From a policy perspective, you can start with more progressive taxation, more continuing education. In their words, a new social protection contract that would involve health care, other benefit portability. And in the private sector, you know, is vocational opportunities, more meritocratic hiring and fair wages. But there's only so much of this that you can mandate. I mean, this is being discussed in our election 2020 in real time.
Well, and you know, good for families that can afford, because they have achieved this level, to help, you know, pull younger generations up. But we're reading from the report that the reason countries care about this so much is that it affects their bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, the report calculates that in the United States, there's nearly a $900 billion economic drag or opportunity cost over the coming decade. And you look at the desperation that this begets, the opioid crisis, the decline in life expectancy. I mean, it's everybody's problem.
Yeah, there's no way up. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Prince Harry has arrived in Canada to join his wife Meghan Markle and their 8-month-old son Archie just days after the couple reached a deal to leave their royal lives behind. Harry spoke publicly for the first time about the situation at a charity dinner on Sunday night.
The decision that I have made for my wife and I to step back is not one I made lightly. It was so many months of talks after so many years of challenges. And I know I haven't always gotten it right, but as far as this goes, there really was no other option.
As part of their deal with the Queen, Harry and Meghan will drop their royal titles and will no longer receive public funds. They have, however, received a lot of public attention over the last few weeks.
Their extraordinary decision to break the mold and step away has left the royal family in turmoil.
It's pretty dramatic stuff, isn't it?
It's a bit of a wow moment, isn't it? I mean, basically, as far as I can tell, I mean, this statement landed in my inbox less than 10 minutes ago. They are resigning from the royal family.
Just 36 hours later, Meghan has gone back to Canada, leaving her husband Harry to deal with what is quite considerable fallout.
Well, now Harry has joined her in Canada, and so has some intense media attention. Just today, Harry threatened legal action over photographers he says are harassing them on Vancouver Island. Joining us now is NPR's London correspondent, Frank Langfitt. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Jeremy.
So as you know, Frank, I love British news. I love Brexit news. I love British politics. But I just couldn't care less about what Meghan and Harry are doing. Why is this such a big deal?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I'm kind of, when it comes to the royals, I'm a skeptic too, for obvious reasons. And unlike you, I'm fully American. My parents are both from the States. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of things going on here that makes this actually, I think, a very interesting story. In one sense, it's relatable because it's about a family, but in the other sense, it's about the royal, so it's otherworldly. And here's some of the elements. You have family strife. You have royalty, of course, celebrity, race. Meghan Markle is biracial, and certainly some of the early coverage of her in the tabloids here definitely was racist. But it's also about business, branding. The royals are a symbol and a tourist attraction here, but they're also very divisive in the country. They're mostly supported by people in terms of the monarchy, but you know, some people still love them, and they imbue people with a lot of national pride. But this, as you know, because you've spent so much time here, it's still a very class-conscious country. Mm-hmm. So they're also seen by many as a complete anachronism and an overprivileged waste of money. And so all of this stuff comes together into some degree like a really easy-to-understand story.
So why does it matter so much to the palace, to the Queen, where Harry and Meghan live? I mean, there is this part about how they're going to drop their royal titles and they're not going to have as sure. many duties. I don't know what those duties really are. But anyway, well, why does it matter where they live?
Well, I think the sense that, you know, they're a part of this brand, and this is one of Britain's top brands. And Britain doesn't have, as you know, doesn't have the kind of heft that it had many decades ago mm-hmm. when it had empire and even coming out of World War II. So people to some degree here, I think, cling to the things that feel world class, whether it's Oxford, Cambridge, the royals. And I think that the idea is that they're leaving. They're, I mean, he says this is always be Harry says this will always be my home. Fact of the matter is they're going to spend the majority of time in Canada and they're already there now. And I think some people look at this and say, hey, you guys got a really nice wedding. The taxpayers spent $3 million renovating your home here, and there's a sense of, well, you know, you're kind of a little ungrateful to us. And of course, as you remember, part of this deal that the Queen brokered involves the couple actually paying back renovation fees for Frogmore Cottage, which is up around Windsor where the Queen's castle mm-hmm. is.
You know, it's interesting, the idea that they're ungrateful. A lot of people have been calling this Megxit, as in mm-hmm. Meghan's exit, but I heard some commentary the other day here in the U.S. about how that in itself was sexist because Harry's leaving too, and maybe it should be called Hexit. Why are they blaming Meghan for the departure?
Well, I think that she is the new person coming in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's an interesting thing, Jeremy. Every woman who marries into the family, whether it was Diana Spencer, of course, later Princess Diana, Camilla Parker Bowles, who eventually married Prince Charles, Kate Middleton, they're always pretty badly treated by the tabloids. Mm-hmm. I think Meghan Markle has gotten it worse. But I think maybe it has to do also with the fact that she's a very different kind of person. She's professional. She's American. She had her own profile. And there's a sense that she's kind of behind this. Now, the fact of the matter is, as we all know, and Harry's been very upfront about this, he doesn't really like being a royal. He blames the press to some degree for the death of his mother mm-hmm. And all of the attention that – I mean that they focused on her. And he's never felt that comfortable in that role. And the other thing that's really interesting about him is that he's very down to earth. And so he sort of – that's also made him one of the most popular royals.
Frank, what about in your own family? Anybody talking about this?
Yes. We talk about it over the dinner table a lot, but let me give you a good example. This morning, my wife goes to a British history class, and they spent the first 30 minutes on Meghan and Harry, and it got very, very heated. And what my wife said that was really interesting is 75% of the people in the class were anti-Meghan. They felt, oh, she'd come here. We'd given her we'd welcomed her, given them a nice wedding, and then she should have known what she was getting into. And then when things get tough, she just cuts and runs. And it was – what was so interesting is how visceral this was, how personal it felt to the people who were in the room. And I think part of that is that a lot of people here kind of think of Harry as their nephew. You know, they've watched him grow up without a mother and they're very protective of him and they tend to side with him and to some degree to side with the monarchy.
Frank, a lot of us here in the United States are watching The Crown. I love it. I just watched an episode last night in the third season. And one of the things that I have noticed in watching that show is that there have been many times when a member of the royal family wants to kind of live their life and the queen has to come in and put the hammer down and say, no, this is sure. You've got a duty. But in this case, she's letting them go.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, a good example of this I think you might be referring to is Princess Margaret, who was the Queen's sister who wanted to marry a divorced man, and the Queen blocked that. And it ended up with pretty tragic results, and I think Margaret's a pretty sad figure. I think what you're seeing here is a lot more finesse. Part of that is this is a different time. Meghan Markle's also divorced, but come on, it's 2020. Nobody looks at it the way that they would have many decades ago. And I think what the Queen's done here is pretty interesting. She is giving them their freedom, but she's also being very clear. It's a tough bargain. She's saying, you know, you're not going to be able to monetize the crown. You're not going to have this His Royal Highness. You won't be able to use these titles. But she's not stripping them of the titles, which is pretty interesting, which means that there is a road back for the couple mm-hmm. or for Harry if this doesn't work out. And I think this is a pretty smart strategy to manage what was a very public crisis. And maybe what you're seeing in this is the Queen as a wise grandmother who's also seen how these things spiral out of control and also how you alienate members of your own family.
Frank, I shouldn't talk to you without mentioning that we're 10 days away from Brexit. What's going on there?
Oh, right. That's right. Oh, right. You're right. Good reminder. Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing is that this has proven a distraction from Brexit. And again, this is a lot easier to understand. It's a soap opera, although real people, of course. With Brexit, we've got, I think, about, 10 days to go. And what's interesting is it is not clear at all what the United Kingdom's relationship with the European Union will be going forward. Brexit is on the night of the 31st. Mm-hmm. And then there are 11 months to put together a free trade deal to kind of rebuild this relationship, which that won't be enough time. And what we're already hearing actually from the Chancellor of the Exchequer is they're not going to be aligned in terms of regulations with the EU, which is going to actually could cost a lot of jobs, could really damage the auto sector here, make it much more expensive to import and export in terms of across the channel into the European Union. So in a sense, we're looking again at some very big impacts. They're uncertain about Brexit. But instead, the last really close to 2 weeks now, we've been focusing on this drama in the royal family.
But just to be clear, for the first 11 months or whatever of –
nothing changes.
Nothing really changes in the transition period.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
Nothing changes. But what's really important, Jeremy, is they have so little time to do so much. And we've seen that the political class here isn't capable of that. I mean, it took forever to get Brexit done. And the idea that you're going to get a complicated free trade agreement done in 11 months – it is entirely, I think for most part, people see entirely unrealistic, which means at the end of 2020, you could have the UK still falling out of the EU with all kinds of economic damage.
Sounds like you're going to be having a good New Year's Eve 2020. Frank Langfitt, NPR London correspondent, thanks so much.
Happy to do it, Jeremy.
Either that or they'll just agree to another 3-month extension on December 30th, 2020. We'll be watching.
Spotify, the global music streaming app and now podcast platform, may be looking to buy the website and podcast network The Ringer. Last year, Spotify bought 3 podcasting companies, Gimlet Media, Anchor FM, and Parcast. So what can we read into these tea leaves? Let's ask Kara Swisher, editor-at-large at Recode, a columnist for The New York Times. And Kara, neither company has publicly said anything about this. So how likely is this acquisition?
Well, it depends. It just Spotify's on the lookout for podcasts, an important podcasting company, and Bill Simmons, what he's assembled there is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
What they want to try to do is get people listening more on the service and differentiate themselves from, say, Apple or other services.
Well, you mentioned Bill Simmons. Let's listen to a little of The Ringer. It's the sports and pop culture startup founded by the guy many of us can say we knew back when he was the Boston sports guy, an outspoken blogger, recruited by ESPN. He wrote popular columns. And then his own startup, The Ringer. Let's listen to a little.
Adam Sandler, Kevin Garnett here. I don't know who I'm more excited to talk about. What do you guys have in common?
Basketball.
You guys have been spending a lot of time together.
Basketball. We love talking hoops. We love talking film. We both share that.
Today's episode of the Ryan Russillo Show on the Ringer Podcast Network is brought to you by State Farm. Just like basketball, the game of life is unpredictable.
Okay, Mally Rubin is here. Special guest Mina Kimes is here. We didn't plan anything out. We're just going to talk about round 2, round
Wonderful.
1, round 3.
So, Kara Swisher, you know, for people who are not accustomed to podcasts, they may be saying, well, that just sounds like talk radio. So let's talk about why Spotify might be interested in podcasts. Last year, they bought 3 major companies. And we saw articles recently saying, well, podcasts may be flagging. What is the state of podcasts and why would Spotify want them?
Well, the big ones aren't flagging at all. I mean, I have a podcast that's just growing, and in terms of revenue,
yes, you
it's the
do.
Same thing. Yeah. So, sure, some of them are flagging. There's probably too many of them, but the ones that are super popular are doing really well, and people like to listen to podcasts. And it's not unlike talk radio. It's the same thing in a lot of ways, except it's over podcasts. So what you have to think about is people like to use these things because radio, you know, is unbearable to listen to because of ads. And these are sort of interesting ads that are often read by the hosts. And they're much easier to consume. And so it's not unusual that people would continue previous behaviors. And he has created, Bill, and among others, Joe Rogan, there's a whole bunch of people who created really compelling offerings on podcasts.
Yeah, talk about how this works. You mentioned ads. Most podcasts do make their money selling ad space. And the firm Edison Research estimates that about 90 million people in the U.S. listen to a podcast every month. That's 3 times as many than a decade ago. But, you know, we're also seeing Peter Kafka write that podcasts are expected to generate around $860 million this year, that ad revenue you spoke of. But the rest of the digital world is $197 billion, you know, in revenue. So obviously there's faith that podcasts are going to continue to grow.
Yeah, I think it's a great place for marketers to try to find some differentiation, and especially when people really have relationships with these podcasters, and Bill is one of those.
Yeah.
I have better relationships with my listeners on podcasts than I do in writing. It's really interesting. It's a really close relationship you have, and, you know, marketers really like it. You know, it's not going to go up and to the right all the time, but it's still an important area of growth, and so it would make sense for something like Spotify to try to differentiate themselves by buying the best in the business, which included Gimlet and some others.
Well, the dominant player now in podcasting is Apple, because they have an app built right into their system. Do we have a war of revenue heating up?
No, there's going to be – Apple doesn't have that many original – I don't think they have any original podcasts. I think they host them. They host mine. They host Bill's. They host everybody else's. That's different. And they may get into original programming. Who knows? They have done it in TV, you know, recently with the morning show and other things. But right now, it's sort of a mix between things like Luminary, which are subscription services for podcasts, which was started by a former HBO executive who knows that business really well. And then there's the ad revenue-based podcasts, of which most of them are. And it's just a question of the big getting bigger. Maybe there's too many of them. It's sort of like the beginning of the web. There were lots of websites, and then some really rose to the top.
Yeah. Back to Bill Simmons, who, again, you know, a lot of people knew him back when he was sort of a pugnacious blogger. And then all this. How much might Ringer sell for? Can you guesstimate?
I have no idea. Allegedly, they have $15 million in revenue, which seems about right. But, you know, he's had his ups and downs. He went to ESPN. It didn't work out quite right. And now he's built this.
He had some suspensions. He had some tweets that people didn't like, columns people didn't like, his executives didn't like. But that's the difference, though, with running a podcast. You do what you want.
Yeah, I love it. It's great. It's really great. You can have on who you want. You can create whatever you want. It's a very creative area right now. And you'll have everything, the gamut from like a Joe Rogan to a very serious podcast. And of course, The Daily from The New York Times is enormously popular and also very lucrative for The New York Times.
Well, I just feel the need to say we have podcasts too.
Yep, we do.
Kara Swisher, editor-at-large at Recode. Kara, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And we also should mention that Vox Media, which owns Recode, has a commercial relationship with The Ringer. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here Now.